Thanks for listening to Olathe Wesleyan Church's online teaching. This week, Pastor Ken begins our four-week series, My Jesus.
We are, as I said earlier, diving into week one of a four-week series, My Jesus. And I want to give a little context. First of all, I want to introduce you to some key people in the story that are going to come up. So here's a picture of myself along with my friend Craig. Craig's on the right. That is his daughter, Vanessa, who was married. Last summer, I had the opportunity of officiating Vanessa's wedding. She married a guy named Ryan that Craig actually approved of. But that's Craig Cooper. I'm going to call him Craig. I'm going to call him Coop or Cooper. Craig and I met at Indiana Wesleyan University when I was a freshman. He grew up in a big church in St. Petersburg, Florida. I grew up in a big church in Grand Rapids, Michigan. There weren't a lot of guys from big churches at Indiana Wesleyan at the time. And we became fast friends. I'd never been in an accountability relationship before, and he said, hey, would you like to get together once a week and meet for prayer? And I was a little freaked out by that. I grew up in church, but that was a new thing to me, to be that close in with a guy and talk and pray about real stuff that guys deal with. Craig is literally, other than God and my wife, Craig is one of my best friends. He's the inner circle of Craig, Tony, and Dan, three of my best friends in life. Next to me on the left, in the picture on the left, is Brian Sexton. Brian and I are really good friends. Brian's from West Michigan. He grew up in Jackson, Michigan. I grew up in Grand Rapids. We would meet up at a lot of district events. Brian was always really athletic. He was really big into football. He was the guy that would show up at youth camp with his football jersey, right? Because he wanted all the girls to know that he played football. And I was more a baseball guy. I'm more a finesse guy, not a football guy. And so Brian and I would actually, we were very competitive in high school together. And then we ended up at Indiana Wesleyan together. All three of us went to college together. And that's very important for you to understand. So Brian and I have been friends since I was probably in junior high. Craig and I have been friends since college days. Craig and Brian met in college, and the three of us just great friends. And I want to tell you a little more context before I dive into the story. The Wesleyan Church, I don't know if you know much about the Wesleyan Church. I don't even know if you know how to spell the word Wesleyan. Okay, I have to spell it a lot when we have vendors call or we're making a sale over the phone. How do you spell Wesleyan? And what is that? It's named after John Wesley. We don't worship John Wesley, but we like his approach to God. We like his approach to Jesus. We like his approach to Scripture. We like his approach to social justice issues in his day and feel that we should carry on that spirit in our day, and we do in a variety of ways here at Olathe Wesleyan. With the immigrant connection ministry that we have, that's a huge social justice issue, and we speak about other issues. A couple weeks, we're going to have Ruth Tisdale from Advice and Aid come, and she's going to talk about their pregnancy center and what we do say and what we don't say to people who are facing an unplanned pregnancy. But the Wesleyan Church, just to give you a little background and some context to the story, the Wesleyan Church is very small. Across the nation here in America, there are probably 2,500, give or take, 2,500 Wesleyan churches. That's not a lot. Not when you consider the size and scope of a lot of Baptist churches or the Methodist Church, as you think about other institutions, churches that worship God, follow God. We actually have more churches outside the U.S. than we have in the U.S. We have around 3,500, maybe up to 4,000. It's crazy how the church is multiplying in other parts of the world. But overall, 2,500 and 3,500, do the math, right? 6,000 churches worldwide. And hopefully growing, not declining, right? That's why we want to plant churches. I'm sorry, there should be an amen right there. But overall, the Wesleyan Church is very small. Now, when I went to Owosso, Michigan, you wouldn't know where Owosso is on a map, but that's okay. It was my first church out of college. I was a worship and young adults pastor. Karen and I had just gotten married. I was there my first year. And I walk into the church, and they have, I'm not kidding you, this huge picture on the wall, in black and white. It's probably 15 by 15 foot picture. And it's the day that they decided to become a Wesleyan church. And I'm looking at the picture, and I'm like, man, that guy looks really familiar to me. It was my great-grandpa George. He was one of the charter members at Owosso. Like, it's just bizarre to me. Like, I mean, here I am, first church, and I walk in, and everybody knows my great-grandpa. Now, my grandpa, my great-grandpa George's son, my grandpa Mel, was a Wesleyan pastor for a long, long time before he passed away several years ago. I went to Indiana Wesleyan, which is one of five Wesleyan institutions that we have. And I traveled for the school, so I met lots of pastors, lots of church leaders. Craig traveled for the school, met lots of pastors, lots of church leaders. Brian also. The Wesleyan Church is very small. It's very important that you understand that. Thelma Clark. If you don't know Thelma, Thelma and her husband founded this church. Well, Thelma goes to Florida. She's done that for a number of years. Goes down to Brooksville, Florida. And, you know, social media these days, I get a note from a former congregation member at our church in Pennsylvania. Karen and I used to serve in Pennsylvania. And there's this lady there named Donna Miller. And Donna, oh, she's a chatty soul. She is a chatty one. So I thought it would be really interesting for her to meet somebody like Thelma. Well, she did. Donna ended up in Brooksville, Florida, and she sends me a note on Facebook. Hey, do you know Thelma Clark? I'm like, well, yeah, she's one of the founding people at Olathe Wesleyan Church. Her husband planted the church. She goes, I'm having the most wonderful time telling her what an incredible pastor you are. And I'm like, I wonder who's going to talk the most in that conversation. It's a small place. Years ago, I was in Russia. I was in Russia. We were doing day camps in Russia. And I've gone four different times. I think it was my second or third time. And so I know the missionaries there, Ken and Marilyn Blake. And Ken says, hey, by the way, we have a special guest coming in. He's just going to be here for a day. He'll be hanging out with your team. And I said, who is it? He said, oh, his name's Blair Ritchie. He's from Texas. I'm like, oh, yeah, I know Blair. He hired my friend Tony. Remember my inner circle? Craig, Tony, Dan. He hired Tony to be a youth pastor. And I knew Blair. Blair actually tried to hire me. And so here we are on the other side of the world in Russia, and Blair walks in, and we're like, hey, and giving each other hugs. And people are like, how do you know these people? The Wesleyan Church is very small. My son Mason's getting married in 3 weeks. He met this girl about a year ago. Here's how it happened. He was in the cafeteria. He saw a cute girl. He walked up to her, and he said, hey, my name is Mason. I'd really like your phone number so I can take you out to dinner. Yeah. Well, Allie, her grandfather is Ken Hare. If you don't know the name Ken Hare, that's a big dog name in the Wesleyan Church. He used to work at headquarters, known all over the denomination. I'm like, Mason, you had to marry a Wesleyan girl? You had to? Like, the way to keep, that's one of the ways the Wesleyan Church stays small. Because we... Well, we're not all from Kentucky, but we act like it sometimes. And if you're from Kentucky, my apologies. My son Marcus goes to school at Indiana Wesleyan University. One of his professors, a guy named Mark Schnell. Mark and I traveled for 2 years together for the university, and now Mark is one of my son's professors. Another professor of Marcus's is named Charlie. Charlie dated my wife. How would that be to walk into class, and there's a guy that could have been your dad? The Wesleyan Church is very small. My son Marcus actually called us recently. He said, hey, I'm seeing this girl. We're making it official. We're dating. I said, oh, yeah, who is it? Oh, Olivia Eckert. Olivia Eckert? Is her dad Jeff? Yeah. Yeah, Jeff and I were in college together. We sang in chorale together. Jeff was a youth pastor at Kentwood Community Church where Daniel worked for a number of years. The Wesleyan Church is very small. And like I said, Brian and I showed you that picture of Craig, myself, Brian. Brian and I grew up in West Michigan. Now, you need to understand this. Craig and I had always dreamed, as we got to know each other, became friends, we roomed together, our sophomore, junior, and senior years of college. Craig and I had always dreamed of working together, serving together somewhere someday, and it never really happened. We had one time where he was working as a youth pastor in Rock Island, Illinois, at Heritage Church, Heritage Wesleyan Church. And I was hired as a connections pastor. But even though we were on staff together, we weren't really working together in the way that we'd hoped. And I was there for a couple of years, and then I went to become a senior pastor. He went back to seminary. And so we had this moment in time where we were able to connect, but it just wasn't like, oh, this is it. This is the moment. It was great, but it wasn't it. And so years passed. I served a couple other churches. He'd gone to seminary. He'd served in Rice Lake, Wisconsin for a number of years. And he got a call to go to a church in Battle Creek, Michigan. Battle Creek is about an hour south of Grand Rapids. That's where I grew up, Grand Rapids. And so I know Battle Creek. I know the pastor there. I know the people there. And I was really excited. I'm like, man, that's a big, cool church with a great history. And Craig's like, yeah, I'm going. I'm going to be the senior pastor. I'm like, woohoo, go for it. So I'm out in Pennsylvania with, remember Donna Miller, Thelma's friend? Remember? Are you making the connections? Okay. So, Don, I'm her pastor. I'm one of her pastors out there in Pennsylvania. I'm there for 5 years. And Craig's been there in Battle Creek about 10 months. And Craig says, hey, he calls me. He says, hey, it's time for you to come. It's time to do ministry together the way we'd always hoped. I'm the lead pastor. I want you to be my executive pastor. I said, okay, tell me about it. Well, you know, we've got 35 staff. Church is about 2,300. We've got, you know, multiple services on Sunday morning. We've got a lot of people coming and going, people that just show up for church. We don't want people to just sit and soak, come for the show, refuse to grow. We want people to not only sit and soak, but we want them to serve. So the challenge of the church, right? Don't just sit and soak, but serve. That was a challenge that First West was facing. It'd become a pretty big production-oriented. I won't even show you pictures of the church. If you saw the sanctuary, you'd understand. Like, it seats 1,800 people. Tim Hawkins, a Christian comedian, regularly comes and does shows there. It's a great venue for a show. It's a little bit interesting for church. And I'm not knocking a big church. I grew up mostly in big churches. I've worked mostly in big churches. I'm not knocking it. Bigger isn't better. Smaller isn't better. You know what's better? Healthy is better. So I don't care about the size of the church. Let's be healthy. Okay? As long as we're healthy, as much as we can be healthy, I know we all bring a little dysfunction to the party. But as long as we can be relatively healthy, that's a good thing. So anyway, Craig called, come be the exec. And I'm like, man, it's my home district. I'm back in Michigan. I'm an hour away from my dad. I'm an hour away from my sisters. I'm working with Coop. What could go wrong? The church had some problems. You know, if you were doing an assessment, right, doing a SWOT analysis, strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, threats, church had some challenges. They'd had an interim teacher. They were without a senior pastor for almost a year, and then been paying a guy to show up and preach on Sundays. And they were paying him, it was a pretty good gig. He was getting paid like $3,000 a month. And he only had to show up and preach. Didn't have to be there during the week. I was like, I want that job. Yes. Thank you, Daniel. You won't amen this one. There'd been a pretty high-profile affair in the youth ministry department. One of the full-time employees who worked under the youth pastor had an affair with a young lady in the church, not underage, but to complicate matters, in order to clarify that it was not an underage relationship, the church board decided they should probably announce it to the congregation. I'm not always a fan of that, but, you know, they did what they had to do. But they chose, this is what I don't like, they chose Mother's Day as the day to announce the details. There were some attendance discrepancies. The church would regularly log to the district. If you ever wonder why myself, Janetta, Jim, if we're really particular about what our count is Sunday to Sunday, whether it's 85 or 86, people are like, who cares? We had 90. It matters to me, and here's why. Because they would normally log 2,500. When Craig got there, he found out they were normally having 2,200 to 2,300. And they found out that some of the people in key leadership, they'd say to the ushers and the other people who counted, hey, what was the count from Sunday? And they'd say, well, it was 2,305. And they say, no, there were more than that. Add 200 to that number. Just pick an arbitrary number. That'd be like me and Jim sitting around and saying, hey, we had 95 on Sunday. And Janetta goes, no, there were 120. Make it 120. We wouldn't do that. So there were some attendance discrepancies, and that's a challenge for a new pastor because, you know, when a pastor leaves, statistics say that somewhere between 15 and 20% will just leave because the senior pastor left and people leave, and I think that stinks. I don't like that. I'm like, be more committed to your church than to a personality, but it is what it is. But they were really taking a ding, and so can you imagine, right? There's insecurity in the church. There's an interim pastor, teacher, he's been getting paid. And he's not working anymore, but he's still, a check's still being cut. There's an affair that's kind of blown up in the church. There are attendance discrepancies. And then I show up 10 months later, and there's a district event, and I'm a Wesleyan pastor. And so I say, hey, you know, notify, I said this to one of the administrative assistants, notify everyone on staff that we're going to the district event next Tuesday. And this administrative assistant said, oh, we don't do that. And I said, what do you mean you don't do that? Well, we don't go to those. Why don't you go to those? Well, we're not Wesleyan. Excuse me? So here's what you need to know, a little more context. I'm not very Wesleyan. Okay, I'm not. Like, I love the Wesleyan Church, but when it comes to, I follow Jesus first. I love our denomination. I actually love our theology, but I'm not like a diehard Wesleyan. Now, some of you want to make me that. Some of you are like, oh, I'm so glad. And some of you are somewhere in the middle. But I'm not. But when that was said to me as the executive pastor, I'm like, yeah, we are Wesleyan. It's on the sign. We're going to this district event, right? How many of you, you work for a company, if somebody was like, well, I'm not, and they name your company, and you're like, it's on your business card. It's on every sign in the building. Yes, you do work for State Farm Insurance or whatever it would be, right? So I'm like, oh boy, we got some problems, Craig. And then I had, you know, a couple other things. We had a youth pastor who was deciding how much longer he wanted to be a youth pastor. And we had a part-time mission pastor who was getting ready to retire. And so those were some complicating issues. But the affair, that was a biggie. The affair was a biggie. Because the guy who had an affair was still coming to the church. And what you need to know in our denomination, if somebody has an affair, they're put under district or denominational accountability. And this guy was refusing district and denominational accountability. And that's a problem, right? But his wife is still coming to the church. But the girl that he had the affair with was still coming to the church. That's a little awkward. Now, it's probably not as awkward in a big church as it would be here, where we have one service, and you can, right now, you can look around and see everybody in the room. It's a little easier. You could come to different services. You know, our first service had 300 or 400. Our next service had 900 or 1,000. The next service had 800 or some more than that. And then we probably had, you know, we had a greeting team, hospitality team of 50 or 60 people every Sunday. So, you know, 2,200 people spread between multiple services. You could avoid each other, but it was messy. Are you with me? It was messy. And so all of a sudden I'm thinking, what could go wrong? Wow, we better be careful with this, Craig. Hey, Coop, we're going to have to tend this very carefully. And so Craig tried to address the affair in a staff meeting. He tried to address it. He tried to say, look, this guy won't come under accountability. He's no longer welcome at our church. It doesn't mean we don't love him. Doesn't mean we don't pray for him. Doesn't mean we don't extend grace to him. But if you're not going to submit yourself when you've wronged not only God, but you've wronged the church, and you won't own up to it. It's tough stuff, right? You guys just got really quiet. Imagine sitting in that staff meeting, which, by the way, his mom was on staff. Told you it was messy. Craig tried to address it, didn't go well. And next thing you know, accusations start flying around the church with about 100 people that there's a good old boys club, that Craig, Ken, and Brian, who went to college together, Brian and Ken, who were friends since junior high, Craig and Ken, roommates and accountability partners since their sophomore year of college, that you know what? They don't know how to lead a big church. They're just working here because they all know each other. Remember, the Wesleyan Church is small. And so at that point, I said to Craig, look, this stinks. I hate the rumors. I hate the speculation. I hate the gossip and the slander. But it's 100 people. And in a church of 2,200 people, cut them loose. Don't worry about it. And Craig's like, I don't know if we can do that. I think we got to try and address it. But next thing you know, before we even had time to even begin that process, news broke that there were secret meetings being held by now more than 100 people, maybe 200 people, calling for Craig's resignation, calling for mine, calling for Brian's. And while Craig was on vacation, I hadn't even been there a year, I found out that one of my employees had called an unofficial meeting of the church board and the finance team. And so I surprisingly showed up, because I got wind of it, said, this meeting is out of order, shouldn't have this meeting. They said, we're going to have it anyway. I said, then I'm going to sit here and take meticulous notes. And what I heard in that meeting crushed my spirit. And keep in mind, Craig's gone. He's on vacation. And so I make a phone call after the meeting, like, man, this thing's about to blow up. He goes, it can wait till I get back. He got back. The board called him in. He asked me to go with him. They wouldn't let me go into the meeting. And they asked him to resign. They asked me to resign. They asked Brian to resign. We were like, what just happened? So Craig's on the phone with district leadership, and oh, don't worry, it's out of order. We have this thing called the Wesleyan Discipline. It's not another Bible. We don't have a secret book. But I just want you to know the Wesleyan Discipline is like our administrative guideline book. And nobody in the world knows the Wesleyan Discipline better than Jim Wood. Amen. That's the truth. That's not even funny. That is the truth. And Craig, we're driving in his truck, and he's like, what do I do? I'm like, we got to call Jim. Jim used to be the assistant to the district superintendent in West Michigan. Jim will know what to do. And I call him, and he's like, oh, you guys are screwed. He didn't say it quite like that. He said, well, what about this? What about this? What about this? And he knows all like the, you know, paragraph 5, section sub B 3, you know, I mean, like stuff I don't even know. Like he paid attention in college in that class. And Jim's like, oh man, this is a doozy. And sure enough, it turns out the meetings that were held were out of order. The decisions that were made should not have been made. But here's the thing. Damage had already been done. And now it's not just 100 people. It's not just 200 people. Now you got 300 or 400 people, right? Because people talk and social media, phew. And so people come to church and there's an anxiety in the air and we're still there. You know, district leadership's like, just keep running the church. We'll have some meetings. We'll get back to you. And we're like, this, you don't understand how urgent this is. But we had another big church in the district that at the same time was blowing up for other reasons. And so district leadership was split on how to handle the crisis there and handle our situation. And finally, district leadership got involved. Now, we can speculate all day, and I don't have time. Did they handle it well? I don't think so. If you ask Jim, did they handle it well? Jim would say, I don't think so. We weathered the storm for a little while, but on August 27, 2013, I received a letter, and Craig received a letter, and Brian received a letter, this time stamped with an attorney's address, threatening a lawsuit against me, Brian, and Craig. And I won't go into all the details of that. It was ridiculous. But following protocol, I was put on administrative leave. I was still being paid. I was sitting at home. I had just hired 2 new staff members. One guy worked with me a week. The other guy, it was his first day. I finally convinced him to quit his corporate America job and answer the call to full-time ministry. He worked with me one day before I was put on leave. I felt so bad for those 2 guys and their families. Here I was inviting them to this mess, and then I wasn't even there to see it through. What made things more complicated, and remember again, the Wesleyan Church is very small. Our denomination, we have districts all over the country. Jim, how many districts do we have? 32? 32 districts, and each church or each district has a certain number of churches in it. Like our district here has around 35 churches, give or take. The church I grew up in West Michigan, Kentwood Community Church, there were like 55 churches in that district. Today there's, I don't know, 65 or 70 in that district. So some are bigger, some are smaller. But we have all these district denominational officials all over the country. And in the midst of all this mess, an anonymous email went out outlining the lawsuit, naming me, naming Craig, naming Brian. In my opinion, defamation of character, and we could not figure out who sent that email. So I met with a lawyer from Detroit. He's a big dog lawyer. He was brought in to do some investigation through our district leadership. And he, I don't know if you've ever met with a lawyer, but he had in his mind what had already happened. He had never spoken to me. And as I start sharing the story, he's like, I mean, he's literally dropping the pen going, what? What? Are you kidding me? I don't know if you've ever met with a lawyer, but that doesn't happen a lot. And finally, after 2 hours with this guy, here's what he says. He said, you know what? They're threatening a lawsuit, but you're the one who should sue. And here's what you should do. You should sue, this is what he said. You should sue this church, First Wes. You should sue your district for not having your back, and you should sue the denomination. And he said, and you, I'll tell you, I've practiced law for over 30 years, you will win. And you will win, you'll take away between $8 and $12 million. But you will never pastor again. May 10 is coming. You don't know May 10, but May 10, 1987, God called me to be a pastor. I had a car accident, should have died, and in the moments following the accident, God spoke to me very specifically. He said, Ken, I want you for the ministry. I'm 48. That call, I was 18 years old. It's 30 years ago. So I'm sitting there with this lawyer who's going, this is incredulous. You should sue. You will win, but you'll never pastor again. And I said, I can't do that. It's not an option. What do I do? He said, I don't know. Not my decision to make. So I called Jim. I had a lot of phone calls with Jim. And I'd say, but Jim, the discipline. He goes, forget the discipline. But Jim, it's our structural administrative procedure book. It doesn't matter. It's not about that anymore. It's a big church that's embarrassed. They're losing money. This is a financial decision. That was hard. That was hard to hear. Jim was right. It was hard to hear. And so now my name is smeared across the denomination, at least in North America, right? Every DS gets that email. I could sue, take a lot of money. Karen would never have to work again. Boys wouldn't have to worry about anything. But I'd never get to do this. And then I met with our general superintendent. We have one big dog, right, in the denomination. At the time, her name was Dr. Joanne Lyon. I've known Dr. Lyon for years. And she said, oh, Ken, I'm so sorry this has happened to you, but you need to resign. And I'm thinking, I was not in a good place. I'm thinking, resign? I'm about to sue you. I didn't say that. I thought that. But she was right. Jim was right. So November 1st, 2013, I resigned due to a lack of follow-up, follow-through, ongoing slander, anonymous emails. I accepted a severance package and I resigned. I was out of work. And you need to understand, I grew up in Grand Rapids, Michigan at a church plant. You wonder why I care about, Jim cares about, why we care about church plants so much. I grew up, I'm a result of a church plant. Kentwood Community Church. Wayne Schmidt, the current general superintendent of the denomination, was my pastor growing up. And I took a lot of pride in that. Like, I am a Wesleyan. Even though I'm not very Wesleyan sometimes, I'm a Wesleyan. My grandpa's a Wesleyan pastor. I'm a Wesleyan pastor. I grew up in a great church in a phenomenal district. You know, even the former district superintendent, a guy named Vaughn Drummond, Vaughn used to pastor that church in Battle Creek. Vaughn was retired, living in Battle Creek, and I'd meet with him. He was like 80 years old, and he loved eating at Taco Bell. And we go to Taco Bell on Wednesdays, and I say, Vaughn, come on. This is what Jim's saying. This is what the lawyer's saying. This is what the district's saying. Vaughn, what do you say? You used to pastor this church. You used to district, you know, pastor this district. And Vaughn goes, I don't know what to tell you. I think you need to resign. And I was out of work. For 9 months, I was out of work. I didn't have any motivation. I didn't want to leave. I didn't want to get out of the house. I didn't want to shower. I didn't want to shave. I got really good at Call of Duty. Some of you know what I'm talking about. Now's a great time to build my KD. I didn't want to leave, though. You know, I'd been at this church less than a year. And keep in mind, it's a church, right? 2,300 people. But I didn't know them all. I hadn't been there long enough. So I go to the grocery store, I go to the mall, and people I don't even know would glare at me. And I know my wife, Karen, and my son, Marcus is still home, Mason was away at college, they go, oh, you're just making stuff up. I'm like, come with me sometime to the grocery store. And people we don't even know, Marcus will go, do you know that person? I'm going, no, I don't know that person. They hate you. I'm like, I know. Why do you think I don't leave the house? We sometimes, if we're going to leave the house, we would go to a town 30 or 40 minutes away, Kalamazoo, or we'd go an hour away to Grand Rapids. We went, finally, Karen got me to work up the courage one night to go out to dinner, and we go to Kalamazoo. We drive 30 or 40 minutes away. We sat down, and some lady with her family, she looks over, and she goes, oh, and she grabs her chair, puts it right next to mine, and says, you're Pastor Ken from First West. And immediately I'm like, friend or foe, friend or foe, friend or foe. The anxiety. Like, what do I do? I was out of work for 9 months. And I'll tell you, I was becoming an absolute mess. I didn't want to pastor again. I would like to tell you that my language was really full of grace. But I was saying some pretty awful stuff in our house about very specific people and circumstances. I was reverting to some habits, old habits that aren't so good. I have a friend, one of my great friends, Tony, he used to be a pastor, lives down in Texas. And he's like, man, you should come be a bartender for me. He owns and runs a bar. He goes, you'll get more ministry done tending bar than any of those stupid churches you've ever pastored. And can I tell you, I was this close. Karen was scared to death. I was this close to taking him up on that offer. And I'm not trying to knock bars, and there's some great people, and people do pour out their hearts, and you can get some great ministry done in a bar. Don't believe me? Read some of Jesus' stories. But I had this call to the local church, and I didn't know what to do. And Marcus would come home from school. He'd be like, Dad, you got to take a shower. Karen's like, do you think you could shave? Do you think you could maybe come sleep in our bed tonight instead of down here in the basement on the couch? I was so depressed. I was so frustrated. I felt so alone. And then I stumbled on this writing, this guy named Remy Diedrich. He'd written this book called Out of Exile, and it's a 40-day devotional journey. There's two editions. There's one for everybody, but then he also wrote this pastor's edition. I was just reading the regular version. The pastor's edition wasn't out yet. And I read a story. Like he said in the beginning, I read the first page and it said, don't read more than one a day. But I was like, I got nothing to do. And I read 28 in the first day. And I finished them all within the next 2 or 3 days. And then I went back and I read them more methodically. And suddenly, Karen and Marcus are saying, what's going on with you? You're changing in a good way. And I'm like, I stumbled on the writings of this guy. I think it's Remy Diedrich. I don't even know if I'm saying his name right, but this is really speaking to me. I want to share the story that really challenged me and why I still follow Jesus and actually why I'm still a part of a local church. I was thinking about it this morning. You know, it's a miracle that I'm even here. It's a miracle that I even know you. We should not know each other. We shouldn't know each other. I should never have met any of you. Because 3-4 years ago, no offense, I didn't want to know you. I didn't want to meet you. I didn't want to be around a church. And I grew up in church. I went to a Christian university. I've pastored a long time. I used to have a hard time understanding when people would say, yeah, you know, I still love God, but the church. And I'd be like, oh, come on. You know what? Now I understand. Now I understand, because the church hosed me. And yet here I am. And I want to share the story that kept me here. All right? So, you don't have to look something up specifically. Let me just tell you a story from 2 Samuel and 1 Chronicles. You want to dive deeper, you go look the story up. It's in the Old Testament, in the Bible. You'll find it in 2 Samuel and 1 Chronicles. Let me just give you some background, okay? There's this guy named King Saul. You ever heard of King Saul? Somebody heard of King Saul? King Saul, he's a mighty leader, but he's an insecure leader. And there's these prophets of God, right? He's a king of Israel, and there are these prophets that tell Saul, do this. No, I don't put that up yet. There are these prophets of God that say, do this, but Saul doesn't do it. He does his own thing. And David, because God sees King Saul not really following hard after him, David is anointed by the prophet to be the successor to Saul. Are you with me? So King Saul is the king, but now God says, Saul's not really my man, so hey, Samuel, go anoint this new guy, David. And there's a whole sub-story about how he didn't think it was David. He thought it was one of his brothers. But David is anointed by the prophet that he'll be the next king. He's not the next king yet, but he's going to be king. And Saul, when he hears this information, right, because people talk, right, Saul becomes obsessed with killing David. Because Saul's thinking, right, if I can kill David, then I'll stay the king. And I have a son, so if I kill David, I stay the king. When I die, my son, Jonathan, he can be the new king. We keep it in the family. Are you with me? And so Saul has his son, Jonathan. But here's the irony. Jonathan, Saul's son, and David, the soon-to-be new king, Jonathan and David are really good friends. Right? They probably shouldn't be, but they are. It's got to be a weird arrangement. There's stories like where David would play music for the king, and the king would throw spears at him. Like, while he's playing music. Like, dude, just let me finish the song. Kill me after. Anyway, Jonathan makes this covenant with David. They have this agreement. Jonathan makes this covenant. David makes it with him. Basically, Jonathan says, I'll make a deal with you. If you promise, you know, when you're king, if you promise not to kill me or my descendants, when you become the king, I'll promise to do my best to help my dad not kill you. And David's like, pretty good deal. So they shake hands. I don't know if they're blood brothers or shake hands or however they bind it up. But it's a covenant, it's a promise, it's an agreement. And not very long after, there's a battle, and Saul and Jonathan, as a result of that battle, they're dead. And David becomes king. Now, I don't know if you know this. Daniel is like one of our history experts around here. When a new king would enter the office of being the king, a lot of times, and even in World Civ, right? You know this? In lots of different dynasties. When someone new ascends to power, what do? The first act, they kill the previous kings or the previous leader's entire family. Why do they do that? They do that to avoid an uprising, to avoid a rebellion. And so Saul, the king, is dead. His son, Jonathan, is dead. David is the new king. And so anybody, if you're related at all, if you're related at all to King Saul, you might want to leave Jerusalem for a while because they might be coming after you. Somebody might kill you to avoid that uprising or the rebellion. Real nice, right? Real nice. Well, one of the family members who fled was Jonathan's son, and his name? Meribaal. And Meribaal means the Lord is against me or the God who fights against me. And see, what happened in the rush to get out of Jerusalem, the king is dead, the king's son is dead. In the rush for everybody to get out, this Meribaal, he's 5 years old, he's got a nurse tending to him, and I imagine she was carrying him, right? It's in Scripture, go read it, take a look at it. In the rush, the nurse dropped him, and somehow he lost the use of both of his feet. He's crippled. He's handicapped. He has special physical challenges. And so the nurse takes him to live in exile 20 miles outside Jerusalem, which 20 miles to you and me with the SUVs and the vehicles we drive is no big deal. But in the days when he didn't have that and he had to walk everywhere, that's a long way away from Jerusalem. And the nurse begins calling him Meribel, the God who fights against me. The Lord is against me. And it's not hard to understand why. His grandfather and his father had been killed. No one knew about the covenant, the agreement between David and Jonathan. No one, who knew? Who knew this covenant? So he was living under this constant threat of being assassinated. He was physically challenged. He can't use his feet or his legs. So think about this, right? In that day, to be physically challenged, to be crippled, was a sign that God had cursed you. Now today, we go, that doesn't necessarily mean anything. It just means you have a physical challenge or setback or limitation. And you can overcome that. Did you see that guy that ran the Boston Marathon carrying the American flag and he's got one of those running blades because he had his leg blown off in the military? And he comes, he's just a big, strong African-American dude carrying the flag. And the crowd in Boston's like, wow, they're like losing their minds. We see that as, wow, that's a great story. In this day, no, God cursed you. So his grandfather and his dad are dead. No one knows about the covenant, the threat of assassination, and he's physically challenged. What's happened to me? No, yeah, the Lord is against me. I mean, think about this. I like the way Remy Diedrich wrote this, so let me just read it to you. One day, this kid is the pampered grandson of the king living in a royal palace. He has his own personal pizza chef. He has custom four-wheelers, chariots, to ride through the Jerusalem hills. Plus, he knows that when he grows up, either his dad or he himself will be the king, but instead, he's a crippled orphan of a dishonored family living in self-imposed exile in the desert. He's cut off from the world and has no future. What's he good for? How will he survive? And oh, by the way, if you forget how difficult your circumstances are, just think about your name. Your name that means the Lord is against me. So he's cut off from God. He fears judgment. He's unable to do anything about it. And can I tell you, that's where I was. That's where I was in November and December and January. I remember praying, God, this wasn't the deal. Craig and I were going to come here. We were going to do ministry together. We were going to build an incredible team. We were going to help this church thrive even more. We were going to plant churches out of this place. It wasn't supposed to work like this. This was supposed to be our dream, and now it's a nightmare. Instead of God taking care of me, it felt like God was working against me. Have any of you been there? Any of you felt that? I pray you don't feel that. I pray you don't have to go through it, but I have been. Have you ever had so many things go wrong in your life that you actually thought God was working against you, not for you? So Meribel, the Lord is against me. The God who fights against me. So something interesting happens. 20 years go by, and David, King David, remembers this promise, this covenant he'd made with his friend Jonathan. And part of it was, I'm going to take care of your family. That was part of the covenant. I'm going to take care of you, you're going to take care of me, and we're going to take care. That's me and Craig, right? Craig knows, if something ever happens to me, I have a file on my laptop. It's true. It's really here. I have a file called If I'm Hit by a Bus. And it has all the information about what to do when I die. And by the way, when I die, steak and shrimp at my funeral. No ham buns, no baked beans from the grocery store. No. Steak and shrimp. You got that, honey? Steak and shrimp. Well, anyway. David is thinking about all the blessings of God in his life. 20 years have passed. And all of a sudden, and I have a question, like, David, why did it take you so stinking long? But 20 years later, he remembers. He remembers the promise. He remembers the covenant. And so he sends a battalion to find Meribel. Now, keep in mind, let's just imagine What has he been doing the last 20 years? He can't use his feet or his legs. I imagine him, I don't know, I'm speculating. I imagine him sitting by the window watching out like, huh, friend or foe, friend or foe, friend or foe. Somebody coming to kill me today? Somebody finally figure out where I was? And here comes a battalion of the king's army. And there's some statements made in this story. I picked three out that I want to share with you. The first statement, the battalion makes to Maribel, they said this, do not fear. We're not here to do harm to you. We actually, we're here to summon you to the king's palace. Oh, I bet you are. Yeah, finally found me. 20 years, you're going to kill me, aren't you? Don't fear. Hey, Maribel, don't fear. Relax, dude. Can I tell you, it's really hard for me to relax. I'm just fast-forwarding. If you want to know all the story, take me out for coffee sometime. I'll tell you the whole thing if you want to know it. But do me a favor. Don't treat me like you don't know me. Because sometimes when somebody shares like this, it's like watching a bad accident. Like, wow, 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 keep moving. Wow, keep moving. Wow. Don't do that to me. But let me fast-forward. So Jim, all of our conversations about the discipline and other stuff, Jim finally says, come check this church out. And I don't want to come. And Jim says, it'd just be good for you to get out of Michigan. So I come, I meet you. I meet this church. I see Olathe, and I'm like, wow, this is pretty cool. I've never been in a church this small. Jim's like, oh, we'll work it out. I'm like, ah, you know, I don't know how you're going to work this out. This is crazy. But anyway, I'm here. Let me tell you one of the do not fear moments I had after I was working here. Thelma Clark called. I wasn't here to answer the phone. And she left this message. Hello, Pastor. This is Thelma Clark. It's very important that you call me. I really need to talk to you. Can I tell you? You might think that's hilarious. I had a panic attack. Because all the calls that I'd had for the previous year or two, when somebody said something like that, it's very important, I need to talk to you, I'm like, oh, goodness. Something else went wrong. I'm in trouble. And I'm literally having a meltdown in the office. It's a true story. And Janetta notices it, and she says, what's the matter? I said, Thelma called, and it's really important. She needs me to call her back. And I'm like, you know, Thelma, it's like founding pastor's wife. Oh, crud, I messed up. I'm getting fired. This is bad. I blew it. I said something really stupid on Sunday. Like, and Janetta says, she might just want to give you a pie. And I said, well, maybe. She said, just call her back. She wanted to give me a pie. But I'd lived so long in fear that I was scared to return a phone call to Thelma Clark. So Maribel's been living for 20 years, looking over his shoulder, wondering who's knocking at the door. And when a battalion shows up, they need to tell him, don't fear, because he's been living 20 years in fear. And his name means, God is against me. Second statement, I will surely show you kindness. When he finally got to the palace and realized David didn't want to kill him, David said, I remembered the covenant. I remembered the promise. I will surely show you kindness. In fact, he said, I'll restore all the land that your grandfather Saul had. I'm going to hook you up like you've never been hooked up before. And I don't know what it's like to live the life he lived for those 20 years, but I know what it's like to live that 9 months when I had no job and my name was in. I mean, nobody wanted to talk to me. I went from being a guy that everybody knew that people would call regularly, hey, is there any way we get you to come to our church? Nobody called. Those phone calls dried up. Nobody called. Nobody wanted to. Don't touch Ken. Don't touch Craig. Don't touch Brian. That's a mess. And Craig got hired, and I got hired, and Brian didn't get hired. And he had to stay in Battle Creek another year. And when I finally talked to him and ran into him face to face, he said, I was insanely jealous that you got hired and that Craig got hired. And I had to continue to live in this hellhole of an existence for another year. And I'm like, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. Like, it's weird, right? I'm sorry I got hired. I'm sorry somebody wanted me. But I felt so guilty. And David says, I will surely show you kindness. Can I tell you, the smallest kindnesses mean so much to me now. I think sometimes over the years in ministry, I kind of miss some of the kindnesses of people. I took it for granted. I don't take anything for granted now. I send thank you notes all the time. I probably annoy people with my texts, appreciating how much they've done or what they do or how they matter, because I don't ever want to miss a moment to say thank you. I appreciate it. That is so cool that you did that. Nobody has to do anything for you. Nobody has to do anything for me. And so David, when he said, I'll show you kindness, I'm thinking Maribel's going, whoa, this is crazy. Nobody's been this good to me ever. And what's interesting, too, is it's not even about Maribel, right? It's about the covenant David made with Maribel's dad, Jonathan. David's not being good to Maribel because of what he did. He's being good to him because of who he is. Oh, there's a lesson in that somewhere, how God sees us. Third statement, you will always eat at my table. You will always eat at my table. I'm embarrassed to say this, but I've been here almost 3 years, and some of you, and it's not on purpose, some of you still haven't eaten at my table, in my house. And let's continue to work to remedy that. I haven't eaten at some of your tables. Let's work to remedy that. But let me just say this. When David says, you'll eat at my table, this isn't just anybody's table. This is the king's table. This is like being invited to have dinner at the White House. And I know some of you are like, well, I don't like who's in the White House right now. Or I didn't like who was in the White House before. Or I won't like the next person that's in the White House. When the White House calls and says, come have dinner, guess what you say? Absolutely. That's what you say. And you go and you behave yourself. And you act respectful of the office. That's what you do, right? And the king, David, says, you'll always eat at my table. And I'm thinking that was probably a little bit out of the ordinary to have a crippled guy, right? Because usually it's full of dignitaries and bigwigs from all over the known world. And now, who's this guy? Oh, he's got a permanent chair. If he's not here, nobody sits in it. It's just his. That's a pretty sweet gig. That'd be like Frank saying, anytime you want to come to Foodies, it's on the house, and I've always got a table open for you. Now, Frank's not doing that. I'm just saying, that's what it would be like. That's what it would be like. So can I tell you one other cool thing? David, when he saw Maribel, he didn't call him Maribel. You know what he called him? Mephibosheth. Now, that's a mouthful. But you know what Mephibosheth means? He who scatters my shame. Not that God is against me. That's not what that means anymore. Not Maribel. It's Mephibosheth. He who scatters my shame. Don't be ashamed. Don't be ashamed of the last 20 years. Don't be ashamed of what's happened. Remember? Don't fear. I'll always show you kindness. You always eat at my table. And guess what? I'm gonna call you a different name. We're gonna change that whole season of your life. We're starting new. And what's really cool is eventually Mephibosheth gets married and he has a son and he names him, I like this, names him Micah. And Micah means who is like God. When people ask me, hey, how's it going at Olathe Wesleyan? And I have a lot of friends who will say, that's a lot smaller than most places you've worked. Pastors do that. I don't know why we measure each other, size each other up by the size of our church, but that's what pastors do. It's a lot smaller than the churches you've worked at. How's it going out there? I'm like, it's incredible. Because when I read this sometime in December of 2013, and I'm weeping at my desk in my home office, and I'm thinking, yeah, who is like God? But I didn't see it. And then Jim calls, and I end up here. And some of you don't know, I've had a lot of these moments privately at home. I get a cup of coffee, I go into the garage and I talk to God. And I say, God, who are you? How did I get so lucky? I could have sued and won, but never pastored again. But now I get to be with a cool group of people who are on mission in Olathe. And it doesn't make any sense. This story does not make any sense to me. I've told Jim, I'm still trying to figure it out. But you know, Jim's a bit of a misfit, and he'll tell his own story. Daniel's a bit of a misfit. He'll tell his own story. Jeanette is a bit. We've kind of all ended up in this place where, like, ministry disillusionment led to this, wow, who is like God? He's doing this amazing thing. He scatters my shame. He strips all this junk away. It's unstinking believable. So the challenging thought I guess I would have for you is this. What do you do? When you feel like you're in a season of exile, when you feel like nobody cares or nobody notices or nobody calls. You know, I was surprised in this season of my life, that 9 months, I was surprised by a couple of things. Number one, I was surprised by who did not call that I thought for sure would call. And then I was really surprised by people who called that I'd never expected to hear from. We had a friend, Gary. He just, out of the blue, he and his wife sent a couple of different checks. And I'm like, I don't need the money. I'm actually getting severance. And he's like, we just want to help you somehow. How are you doing? I didn't expect to hear from Gary. But then I had some people I was like, why haven't you called? You know that Reba song? Tell me why haven't I heard from you? Why haven't I heard from you? And I had people, I'm like, why haven't I heard from you? But what do you do in exile? You have a chance in exile. Oh gosh, you have a chance to get bitter or to get better. And Daniel said something in teaching team this week that I fully agree with, but I really don't like, and it's this. God never wastes a hurt. God never wastes a hurt. I don't know that God causes hurt. I don't know that God likes the hurt, but somehow God is redemptive, right? That his nature is redemptive, and he'll take a huge hurt, a season of exile, and he'll bring something good out of it. I don't know how he does it, but he does it. He never wastes a hurt. So what do you do? Because if you haven't had exile, you're going to have it sometime. If you've had it before, you might have it again. I hate the idea that I might have it again. But you know what? I'm stronger. I'm better. I'm not everything I need to be. I'm not everything you probably want me to be. But I'm so much better. And here's the bottom line for me. This is what I learned. There is a friend who sticks closer than a brother. Jonathan and David had this incredible relationship, but Craig and I had this incredible friendship and relationship. But you know what I found in this season? As much as Jim helped me, as much as Vaughn Drummond helped me, as much as Janetta and Daniel helped me, as much as my own wife, my son Marcus, my son Mason, my dad, as much as all those people helped me, I had huge chunks of time alone where I had to say, who is God to me? And not the church, because the church, if you put too much stock in the church, it'll let you down. But I found out, and keep in mind, I've been a pastor, right? And I grew up in church. I've heard this 1,000 times, literally. I have taught this hundreds of times. I've read it. I've said it. I've prayed it over people. But now I was understanding it in a way that I had never understood it before. There is a friend who sticks closer than a brother. When no one's around, nobody's returning your calls, people you thought would call don't call, people you thought would care seemingly don't care, God shows up. Now, I'd love to tell you I'm all better. But there are times where something out of the blue will trigger an emotion. Just out of the blue. And my wife's like, what's the matter? And I'm like, I don't know. And then there are times where you'd think I would respond very emotionally, and I'm just like, hey. So there are times I don't even make sense to myself, but God is faithful. He is a friend who sticks closer than a brother, and he will be with you in your season of exile. And that's my Jesus. That's my Jesus. That's why I still love him. That's why I serve him. And that's why I follow him. Let's pray.
Thanks for listening to Olathe Wesleyan Church's online teaching. To learn more, visit us at olathawesleyan.org or visit us on a Sunday morning for our 10:30 a.m. worship service. Thanks so much.